You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Across the Desk
with Clement Maniatela
on 702.
So, time for Across the Desk. And as I said earlier today, we are exploring the world of poetry. And I've got storytellers, people who tell their stories through their poetry, their performance. And we're just going to be exploring poetry, right? And how they do it, how they write. You know, I'm interested in often conversations about poetry as a form of protest, as a form of activism. So, and if you are a poet yourself, I'd like to hear from you. Give me a call on 011-883-0702 or send me a WhatsApp voice note on 072-702-1702. So let me introduce you to my guests. Tabiso Afurakan Mohare. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes, you did.
We practiced before we went on AM. Thank you for making time, Tabiso.
Good morning, Clement. Thank you for having me.
And Mandisa Vundla.
Hi.
Thank you for making time, Mandisa.
Ah, you're welcome.
You guys are good?
Fantastic.
You look like someone. Is there someone people always tell you look like?
No, I just have a familiar face. I think I have that effect on people.
Okay, yeah.
Like, almost like you know me.
Yamazi, yes. So, Tabiso Afurakan.
Yes, sir.
What is that?
It's a name, right? So when I was young, about 1920,
yeah.
I read very interesting research that was done by the late Zinzi Mandela,
mm-hmm.
I think, and her husband then.
Yeah.
And it revolved around like this ancient civilization in northern Africa, Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And the name they used for the continent was Afurakan.
Wow.
So, and there's a bit of sort of a story of evolution of the name, you know, Afurakan, Afrique.
Yeah.
Africa, so sort of language evolving,
nice.
And so forth. So when I read that research, I found it very interesting. The lifestyle that they were living, the systems that they were using, which was sort of like counterclockwise to what we're doing here.
Mm.
I fell in love with the name. I fell in love with the concept behind it. And I was like,
fascinating.
Difficult
to pronounce. At 20, you are busy reading research.
Yeah.
I was busy memorizing. I mean, I'm rereading books now that I read when I was like young in varsity because I read them for academic purposes.
Right,
like I'm rereading The Tale of Two Cities because I realize only now how fascinating it was then. But then I was reading it because I needed to write an exam.
Yeah. Now you're like, oh, this is what happened.
This is what happened. Jeez, the French Revolution. When did you start being passionate, Mandisa, about poetry?
Oh my goodness, I was a teenager.
Yeah.
It wasn't something I did consciously. I was just writing. I think as a form of just surviving myself, you know, surviving life. So I just started writing. I think at 14, I did like, it was the orals, you know, and I wrote this poem and I thought, oh my goodness.
Mm.
This is probably the best thing I've written ever.
And you knew then that it was the best thing. She was feeling herself at 14.
And then I grew up in a community theater.
Yeah.
And so I was one of the few who was actually doing poetry, writing poetry. So I was encouraged a lot, you know, and I used to write poetry for plays, the plays that we did, June 16 and so forth. But I think thereon after, in 2009, I joined Facebook and I found a community of poets and I was intrigued and I thought, oh my goodness. So we used to literally just collaborate online and we used to just write online, you know, with people we never met and we built friendships, poetry friendships. You know, and then in 2011, I made a conscious decision. I said, I want to do this professionally.
And how old were you at the time?
How old was I in 2011? Was I 20 something?
Okay.
My early 20s.
Early.
Yeah,
okay.
My early 20s, I think. And I was like, I want to do this professionally. And then I started looking for platforms, but they were very scarce. And I kept asking, guys, where's the poetry industry? Where's the sector? Where do we go to? You know? And I think I came in the era after Horror Cafe and everybody was just like, well, the industry collapsed, you know? And I didn't know what that meant. But after a while, I mean, I started meeting a few poets, you know, one poet will tell you about a session that's happening tomorrow, next Saturday. So House of Hunger, Word and Sound. And so the community grew, you know, because now you're going, you're attending these very few and far in between shows, but you're seeing the same people who are equally passionate. And I think from there on, I tapped into it via slam poetry route because Tabiso Mohare decided he was going to start Word and Sound and turn it into a slam poetry poetry league, and I jumped on it, and that I never looked back.
Yeah,
yeah.
When you started writing, Tabiso, did you know you were writing poetry, or were you just expressing yourself? Because it could have been a song. It could have been it could have been part of a book you published later in life. So was there an intention that I'm actually writing poetry? I'm intentional about how I'm even structuring these. Is it stanzas and what?
At some stage, there was a conscious decision to say, and I'll tell you why, because I grew up on hip hop. So high school, I was, I grew up during the golden era of hip hop. So let's for those who are old enough, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Hey.
So, but I got towards 1999, 2000, the sound of hip hop and the content started changing. And that affected me a lot. And then I came across a gentleman called Saul Williams. And I came across Z Ngube as well. And I was like, that's what I want to do. And they were doing what's called poetry. I was like, no, but that's not poetry. My teacher said Shakespeare's poetry and other things. So then that seriously challenged me, because I was hearing voices that spoke things that were relevant to me, that sounded like me, that was not really hip hop, but still had rhyme in it, still had rhythm in it, still had flow. So that's how I was like, you know what? I quit hip hop. I am going to become a poet. What is this poetry thing? And I think I started exploring that just after high school. And there's a gentleman called Flo Mukale. He came to my neighborhood in Spreadview. He was already into poetry and he was like, yo, there's a movement in Johannesburg, and that's how I got into it. But I think it was a conscious decision to say, look, hip hop is limiting in terms of what I'm trying to say, in terms of format, in terms of content. What else is there that can allow me to, expand on my thoughts? And poetry for me became that. And it challenged what I'd been taught in primary and high school around what poetry is.
I want you to prepare to give us a little something. Little something, something. But while you prepare to do that, how do you define your kind of poetry?
Oh my goodness. Somebody actually said to me, you are such a South African writer,
And what did you say? What do you mean?
Yeah, I was just like, but it actually took me back because I was just like, actually, I really am. Yeah. I'm such an archiver of just African culture, African women, black African women, the conditions that we're facing in South Africa. I am a South African writer, but I really document my life and the challenges, the way I navigate the world, how I navigate the world and the challenges and those limitations actually that I face. I break those limitations when I write. That's the reason why I write poetry. I could have a bad day. I could not believe in myself today, but let me finish a poem about that and see how I feel later. It literally changes my psychological frame of mind, and so I've been writing to survive as a black woman living in South Africa.
Wow, that's so profound. What about you? How do you define your kind?
Ramblings, poems, and whatever. That's really
that's
what it is.
That's a bigger room for many different other things.
That's it. It's a protest against everything. It's a protest against poetry itself. Yeah. It's a protest against form. It's a reflection of what's going on. I think Ntate Wallace Ruta said something very profound that stuck with me, that a poet's job is to listen to the many different voices, opinions, and then sort of summarize them or bring them together and give the nation sort of, something to reflect on, but in a collective, summarized way. That's very hard to do, to sort of take a million plus voices and encapsulate them into one feeling, one message, so that's what my poetry attempts to do. That's why sometimes it's not even poems, it's just ramblings.
So I have a stupid basic question, really.
Sure.
How do you memorize? I watched yours.
You have to be young.
I mean, Tabiso's one, I watched one, which was like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's like, what? And then I saw yours, I think it was about 5 or 6, the one I saw on YouTube last night. Yeah. I'm like, how do you do it?
Well, initially I did it because I jumped into the performance aspect of poetry. So you don't even ask yourself, how am I going to memorize these lines? You just know that it's the prerequisite, and the pressure with slam poetry actually gets you to that place where you're just going to be singing your poems like a song. But the best trick is to start memorizing whilst you're still writing. So sometimes when you write, right, you'll find that for a fact stanza one is complete. I'm not touching it. I'm moving on to stanza two. But every single time you are reading or recapping the entire poem, what are you doing? You're always reading stanza one, right? Yeah. So then you start memorizing stanza one. So by the time you've finished with the poem, you actually really have like the last bits to memorize. Yeah, that's how I'm.
What's your trick? Because you won't be young forever.
When I was younger, same thing. As you write, you start memorizing. There's rehearsal techniques as well. The more you rehearse, you know, the more sticks into your head as well. Mm. Depends on how you write. If you're a visual writer, you know, those visuals help you. I find that now, because I do a lot more corporate performances, I have to do sort of short cramming spans. So I will do like 48 hours of just getting the poem into the head. But you know, just that one poem, 3 minutes on stage, and afterwards it's out of your head, you know. So it depends on the pressure.
Isn't it limiting though when you do corporate gigs? Like,
no,
because I listened.
That's fun.
The one I listened, I mean, there were words there on that poetry which I wouldn't have played on air. So if you had a corporate gig, because also as a poet, you want to genuinely and authentically express yourself.
No, can I break that misconception? Uh-huh. Right, poetry is a form of literature. It's a form of writing, and there isn't one form of poetry. It's not just protest. It's not just us being angry. It's not just us cursing at people. Like, Poetry is creative writing, and creative writing falls into creative communications as well. You know what I mean? So for me, I'm a copywriter. I've been in advertising. You know, I perform in corporate. For me, it's that I'm helping corporates. I'm solve communication problems. I perform at their conferences. I rewrite some of their corporate communications as well. So for me, it's the creative and the soul and the, you know, inspiration that I bring to what would otherwise be very cold corporate and business copy, you know what I mean, or business setting. So poetry is not just about, you know, the protest and social reflection, but it's also a creative tool for, I always say that copy is needed in every single sector, right? So poetry is also needed in every single sector.
Do you do corporate as well?
I haven't done corporate in a while. Yeah. I haven't done corporate in a while. But I just wanted to say, I mean, just like any other art form, right? Poetry is also a business, right? So if you are a business, you're not going to just focus on the liberating aspect of your work. You know, the part where you're like, I'm going to go perform these at events where people are ready for this, or where it doesn't matter what I say, you know, nobody's paying me for this, right? But I do think that growth and maturity comes with expanding your mindset as a poet, you know, as a working poet. I've been commissioned to do work, you know, before, you know, where somebody will come and say, please write, this is what I want, this is the direction that it must take, you know, do whatever it is that you want, but you are writing within a frame, you are writing within somebody's expectations. So it's very important to also be able to navigate that as a working poet, you know, and to understand that it comes with maturity to say, I don't have to keep to the content I've been creating for Mandy. Now somebody has realized that I can create and I can write like this for Mandy. Well, they would like for me to write like this for them and for their objective.
Like that. Okay, so Thabiso, can you give us something? I'm going to take your calls, by the way. 011-883-0702. If you are crazy about poetry, if this is something, maybe you've got questions, in fact, about poetry. You can give us a call. If you maybe want to even recite something, if you want to send a WhatsApp voice note, I'll take those as well on 072-702-1702. So what are you giving us?
Black people rock. I was asked to read this one. Yeah, it's not controversial.
It's fine. We love controversy.
Right. But it tries to celebrate sort of the musical relationship between mining and mine workers, you know. For us, there's a deep history of that. If you think about gambus dancing and, you know, Ngomabsugu, there's a whole lot of stuff in that. So
what is it titled?
Black People Rock.
Black People Rock.
Yeah, sure. Rumor has it that the roots of rock as we know it score whispers of truth and leave human records unspun as ambition-propelled note streams. Rumor has it that we, compositions of clay, who speak sandstorms in the dialect of rock, carry score sheets of origin as patterns of skin tone. Can you dig? Yes, I can dig. We have dug rock and played its tragedy on world stages around necks of legends. Between rock breaks, bass kicks, and hi-hats, we have given life and limb. We improvise the art of digging rock, yet stand with a fist full of sound as descendants of soil. Can you rock? Yes, I can rock. We have danced bullets and rocked oppression out of fashion, tattooed rock on the tongue of memory, and now the world sings our names. And who are we? We are the underminers, and undermines, we are undermined. Migrant roadies who beat rock. We beat rock with a gumboot beatbox. We let the beat rock. Through unplugged volumes of rock, rough jewels bear their rock-crushed backs in pursuit of their destiny to shine. while mine is a legacy of blood, a chorus beneath the earth, instruments of greed. We compose the riches of rock, yet sing hunger to the night. My royalty was life, unspoken, it hurts, buried in a verse, the irony of words, truth spoken, but not heard on how you still fish the earth. While they rhyme about platinum and gold, music is the canvas, and we paint secrets untold. And when the album is done, and black label satisfies a black labor thirst, we play a new rhythm. Backstage, while you tow statues of our labor, we play a new rhythm. We beat rock. Hell at the beat rock.
Wow. Whew, that's, geez, the way you play around with words, eh? Like rock, dig. Do you think there's the influence of hip-hop?
Yes.
You did say you decided to move.
Yep.
Do you, I mean, is there a lot of that influence because of that background you have?
Yes, there is. And language as well. Just, you know, the musicality of language. I think one thing, you know, I'll give black writers is that our indigenous languages, Vinek, is very musical. So we bring to English what English lacks. The musicality, you know, that's why English is such a technical language. So we break it. We, you know, that's why academia hates us so much, you know, because we try get English to dance, you know, in the words of the late Ntate Korapetse Kgosietsile, you know, we try get English to dance. So wordplay, playing with meaning, you know, that's for me. And hip hop. You know, through rhythm and rhyme, alliteration, assonance, you know, the basic, the stuff you were taught in high school. Now you're like, oh, okay, it makes sense now, you know. So that's the tools that I use to sort of try get English to dance on paper and on stage as well.
Yeah. Mandisa?
Hello.
What are you giving us?
Gravesite.
Yeah, let's go.
I catch news of your death. The way wood catches a fire with your body before it is burnt. You are somebody's daughter, returning to ash before returning home. I keep meeting women for the very first time as passengers of death, as still images taken before their last breath, as dying proof for the living that the shallow hearts of men can love you into a grave, that the head of your home can lay you down as a headstone, loving you in memory. When a man says he wants me, I don't know if he wants me dead. Men choreograph their rage so beautifully on our bodies. The post office is an opened envelope sealed with blood. You do not know if the parcel you are sending is your daughter to her grave, if the funeral procession will replace her graduation day, and to what degree. Dismembering her body is also cutting short her dreams. Dreaming while black is a revolution delayed. Dreaming while black woman is a revolution denied.
Ooh.
A dream with soiled hands and sinking feet. A body broken like a promise, safe, couldn't keep. We are chasing our dreams while being chased on the streets. We are reaching for the stars while someone keeps reaching for our bodies at home, at work, at school, at play. Dreaming while black is a revolution delayed. Dreaming while black woman is a disappearing act.
Shoo, shoo. So you clap because, I mean, you're saying some truths. But there's a part of me that's also sad because of what you are expressing as a reality, not just for black people, but more so for black women. Just take me through when you were writing Gravesite, what you were trying to express and what you were going through in your mind.
It's grief. You know, it's constant grief. Usually when another, you know, woman is murdered or raped, you know, I take time, I keep quiet, you know, and I sit in it, you know. And sometimes when I translate that grief, I ask myself, what am I trying to say? What does this mean? You know, it's like I really keep meeting women for the very first time as passengers of death. You know what I mean? It's like I met Nene for the first time, just slightly, you know. It's like I keep meeting these women. I don't stop meeting these women, you know, as passengers of death. And really, dreaming while black is a revolution delayed. It really is. I mean, we know black people have been starting on a back foot for a very long time. But as a woman, I feel like I'm not even given the feet to start. I have them, but I can't even use them because I'm in constant danger everywhere I go. Every time when I'm trying to glow at work, at home, at school, at play, it's like you're just in constant danger. And we're living with like literally one eye open and one eye focused on where you're going, one eye turning to see who could be potential danger. We're afraid of almost every male that we come across on the streets, or I am particularly. And I think the poem really expresses that grief, that frustration, and that concern. You know, it becomes a lot for me at times, and I'm just like, I may not be able to resolve this, but I need to be able to breathe when I walk out the house. And so I'm just going to write for that breath.
Sure. I had a conversation with a friend, in fact, last night, about Bekitele. I don't know if you guys saw the video of Bekitele saying shut up to this gentleman, and we were having this complex discussion about, okay, who is wrong, right? Tele, we expect a lot, he's a minister, and you've got this guy who is so right wing and has context that I believe shapes how he thinks about black people. When you look at what he's been tweeting, when you look at the time he was at AfriForum, his context and what he has said shapes how he looks and views and relates to the black people. And this female friend of mine said, in this moment, I don't have time to look at the wrongs of this man. I'm looking at the failures of Kelly because as a woman, I'm in constant danger and he is failing me. And for me, that's the immediate risk I have. I'll deal with this man. I don't justify what he said, but right now,
The urgency
is, yeah, this man is failing us as women, because it's no longer even the I'm scared of, because for the longest time, a rapist has always been a man who, oh, the one who's dirty, who's roughed up, who's going to meet you on the street and push you into the bush. And no,
everybody,
you could be at home,
potential face of,
you could be at the crèche, you could be at church, you could be at work. The people we have not seen as the risk are the people that could violate you as a child, as a woman. And geez, that's just how I've been reflecting after you read that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Mandisa. I've got your WhatsApps, by the way, coming through. I'll play the WhatsApp voice notes after the latest in Eyewitness News headlines, and we'll continue this conversation with Thabiso and Mandisa.
Across the Desk
with Clement Manyathela
on 702.
11:33 on Across the Desk. I'm hosting Thabiso and Mandisa. We're exploring the world of poetry, and my goodness, what they gave us just before the headlines, yeah? Incredible stuff. So I'm going to go to your calls now on 011-883-0702, WhatsApp voice notes as well on 072-702-1702. But before I do, Mandisa, earlier you spoke about the poetry industry and how at some point you were asking, is it still even there? It's scarce. What's the situation now?
Oh, there's a pulse, and it's beating, and it's beating loudly, it's beating wildly, you know? I just think we're at a place where there's a pulse, but we need to figure out a way to make it sustainable. And Brother Ishmael Muhammad said something very powerful about that pulse. You know, he said that we're going to still have to do the work to keep on sustaining first the audiences, so that eventually we do have community that actually is able to support our industry. But the pulse is kicking, it's ticking. Poets are doing amazing things. Looking at Sipho Ghazijonas, who just did We Are Dying Here, a whole film scripted in poetry that has just been blazing the film industry and the poetry sector. What Kolega's doing in theater, we're producing spoken word poetry albums. We're no longer boxing ourselves to the stage and the page, because I think for a very long time we thought that to succeed you had to perform, get booked, do international festivals and publish a book, you know, but all those things don't give you a sustainable income. So I think we're at that transition point where we need to be asking, how do we structure the industry? What is needed to consolidate the efforts of poets and organizations who have been working in silos? You know, we have people who've been working in clusters, but how do we consolidate the industry to say, this is the industry, this is what the industry is worth, this is what we can produce, and where do we get the funding to do so?
Yeah, Toby, so how do we do that? How do we sustain that audience? How do we sustain that pulse so that it continues beating loudly and wildly?
I think just to add on to what Mandisa was saying, I mean, I'm fortunate now, I work also as a grant manager. So in essence, I get to manage funds for the creative sector and get to see what happens behind it. I think one of the things we need to desperately improve is administration around the arts. I think in South Africa, I mean, short of a better word, our arts administration is corrupt. You know, and that's where a lot of the money and the investments get lost. That's where a lot of the mismanagement of the investment happens, mm-hmm. because our administration of the arts sector is not up to our standard. We're talking about financial administration. We're talking about just ideation. We're talking about policy making, research, being able, for example, poetry needs the same kind of ecosystem as music does. You know, we need people who are managers. We need people who are accountants. We need people who are booking agents, people who are doing PR and content for poets, you know. We need people who are running organizations that are running festivals and booking poets. We need people who are managing grants to distribute to poets, people who are able to be the bridge between, let's say, international funding and local poets. We don't have any institutions, you know. I think for me, poetry has been one of the least invested in disciplines and sectors in South Africa. Corporate South Africa is probably the biggest investor in literature and poetry specifically right now, through their marketing budgets, not even through the CSI budgets, through their marketing budgets. Let's not talk about Department of Arts and Culture.
Oh, no. What's that?
Let's not talk about the scandals and the money that's been lost, you know. So for me, I've been in this for 20 years, and we've done a lot of work in getting the raw talent out. We've built platforms to get 16-year-olds off the street onto a stage and show them the trajectory. But once they hit 24, 25, there isn't a administrative system or setup, an ecosystem that allows them to thrive. You know, we're only seeing it now for the first time, where we have to dabble into other spaces. So I heard for the first time this AR copy, what is it? Artificial intelligence copywriting. And I'm like, whoa, that sounds incredible. I want to get poets into that. You know, poets are doing AR and VR now with their poetry as well. But that's us starting to sort of expand this little traditional sector that goes beyond stage and books into a multimedia, multi-production art form. Poets themselves starting to think beyond just writers, but become multi-media content producers. We ran a digital slam, I think, last year after COVID, and it took poets from being just, you know, I want to get on stage and perform, to say, now I need to produce a video. I need to understand what it means to shoot, to edit, to work with sound, you know, from just writing. Now we've seen how they've, you know, moved on to become multimedia producers. So there's a lot of background work that needs to happen. Like I said, it needs, like Mandisa said, it starts with the players sitting down. But I think we also need a lot of corporate and government intervention. Let's build the structures. Yeah. Let's build the admin structures. Let's build. It's not good enough that we're not in schools. You know, simple thing. You know, there's a catalog of South African writers. It's not good enough that publishing is still white. You know what I mean? The only time you get black literature is if it's self-published. That's fine. I still want to own my copyright. But can somebody partner with me to print copies so that we can get them out there, so we can sell them and so forth? You know, so we need raw investment. Let's sit at the table and structure literature and poetry in South Africa like any other professional creative
sector. Just to quickly add to that, I mean, so we came together with myself, Africa, Mamukhati, and Flo Wellington to start the South African Poets Guild. And we have started it. And I think that what I was saying, you know, the fact that, I mean, when we went through COVID, there were sectors who had certain governing bodies that they could go to and knock and say, what's the plan? We sat and we were knocking on each other's doors. You know, it was a poetry organization that was trying to fundraise. So with the South African Poetry Guild, we are trying to then say, then who do we look at and how do we consolidate what Tabiso is saying? How do we put that within the national poetry framework to say, this is how poets can be supported? And those who have been doing the work for so long, how do we then elevate and amplify those voices and put them in a position where, I mean, just like Tabiso was saying, commercial music is commercial. You know, a musician goes on television, on radio, whatever music of theirs, whatever they sing, there's a way of collecting that money and that fee.
Exactly.
It would be fantastic for poets to do the same. You know, after we've just performed these poems, to be like, okay, cool, royalty fee collection in this particular way. But we've come a long way, but there's still a lot more work to do.
To do. All right, let's go to some calls now. Let's start with this voice note.
Hello, Clement and the listeners. Okay, I have maybe two questions. Maybe they've already been discussed because I just tuned in now. I would like to know if, firstly, is there money in writing poetry? And secondly, is there an audience? I mean, from where I'm from, Ekasi, I don't know a single person who reads or writes poetry. So yeah, thank you.
That's interesting, because it's not so much because there is no people who are passionate about poetry, but there's no space for them, right?
True. Yeah. I think it's such a catch-22. So one, on the money part, right? If you're to look at poetry, there's no money in poetry, but there's money in writing. So I said to myself, I want to be a writer. Poetry is one of the things I write. So then that has allowed me then to be able to make an income as a writer. So I've been able to work in advertising. I have been able to do freelance work, as a script writer. I'm now working as a fund manager, you know, so all of that has me saying, I want to be a writer and explore different types of writing, you know, so I would encourage that. There's screenwriting, there's playwriting, there's writing for TV, for radio, for pretty much every sector. So there you can sustain yourself. But if you want to just to do just poetry, you have to think beyond South Africa. We don't have a market big enough for you to be able to say, let's say you get booked every month, be able to do those shows. Even if you publish a book, I mean, here you need to sell 300 copies to be a bestseller. That is like, yo, the bar is low. You know what I mean? How much money do you make from 300 copies? First of all, you know, so you have to start, you know, thinking outside of South Africa. If you want to just do poetry, you have to look at where else can your poetry go, beyond books and stage. You know, what can you license it to? Film, animation, music, radio. Can you write for other people? You know, so it's, you have to look at international networks. Where else can you go for residencies, scholarships, festivals? You know, so you really, really have to think much bigger if you want to make money purely from poetry in South Africa.
Is there money? Is the audience?
There's definitely audiences, right? But like Tabs was saying, those audiences, are they big enough to sustain you every single month? You know, are they big enough to book you? You know what I mean? And also those audiences are audiences we've developed. Like we've literally, it's not like we went out and said, hi, I have a show. And then there are like 30,000 people coming in through the door. No, when you are a poet and you are curating shows, you have to have a plan on how you're going to strategically get people in through the door. But an alternative way of also making an income is looking at the development sector, right? So how are you positioning yourself for as a mentor, for instance? This is what I do, right? I also mentor, and
your
I'm
kids.
I mentor my kids. So I mean, we did a program, a project in 2016, 2017, Next Generation Speaks, and we went to the U.S. in California, right? They run something called Brave New Voices. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was like the biggest youth poetry platform curated, like in the world, right? Where poets will come for the developmental aspect, but also for the slam aspect. But most of the poets that were there were poets who were workshopping at schools, were poets who were finding ways to also master the developmental aspect and curate for development, right? So that's the part that I'm looking at to say, well, we don't really have poetry development institutions in South Africa because the sector hasn't developed to that degree. You know what I mean? So how do you then become, how do I become a person who starts leading on the front lines with that conversation? But if you're going to do poetry alone, you, on your best days, you're going to have money. There is money, but it's not sustainable. You know, when you're on high rotation, it's fantastic. You're making money here. There's going to be a pause or a drop at some point.
Then that's trouble.
And then you have to figure out.
Before your kids, you're fine.
Before
your kids, you're fine.
Okay. And then when they come, then
go ahead and get married. Go ahead. Let's see you.
You need serious money, guys.
Let's go to Joburg now. Mondi, good morning.
Morning, Clement. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm very well, and I'm so happy to finally get through.
Thank you for your patience, Mondi.
Okay, no problem. Clement, I'm actually happy because you hardly hear poetry, like poetry sessions like this. And I would like to say to your guest, big up. And I don't know how we're going to do it. I'm a poet myself. I'm a filmmaker. And I would love to see poetry, as Usus Mandisa says, is huge in America. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about two weeks ago, I downloaded poetry from, it's Maya Angelou's poetry when she was very young. And I shared it on my statuses on WhatsApp, and my friends, in fact not friends, my contacts were like, actually happy, where do we get poetry in South Africa? Where can we go and listen and watch slam poetry? And I'm like, I actually don't know, because the Department of Arts and Culture is not coming to the show. I would like to know from your guest, Bukuti, what are their plans to actually to grow this industry
and keep that pulse, right? Which Mandisa was talking about.
I think first of all, thank you for the question. The first thing I would advise you to do: go to YouTube and look for Word and Sound, WORD letter N Sound, SOUND, Word and Sound. We have got amazing videos that we've been putting up since 2010 of local poets. And we did that specifically as an experiment. Before 2010, the only videos you'd find of poetry were American videos: Maya Angelou, Saul Williams, Ursula Raka, Stacey Enchins, and so forth. So a lot of young writers in South Africa were writing based on those voices that were sounding like. It was only up until we started showing them their own peers, own South Africans, started hearing similar dialects and you know, that they started writing like themselves. So having a visual representation of our voices and the poetry that we do online is important, because this is how young people discover poetry. This is how we share poetry. So we started that mission 10 years ago. I'm glad you're a filmmaker. We would love to collaborate. We've got some archive footage. We've got Mandisa's first performance, for example, in 2011.
I don't want to see it.
You don't want to see it. We have it. You know, so
I'm going to check it out.
There is room for working with archives that we have, but there's also more room for creating new content now, especially that the world is a lot more digital. Data is a lot more accessible as well. There's a lot more room for us to put up a lot more videos. So if you've got some pockets, Nyana, or time or resource, we'd love to collaborate. Challenge us, please.
We'll get you guys in touch
for sure.
With Mondi.
And just to add on to that, I run something called Poetry Zone ZA, which is a poetry development agency, which is really focused on improving the spoken word poetry in South Africa. And so what we did is we launched Brave Spoken Youth, which literally focuses on the youth between ages of 13 to 29 every last Thursday at the Soweto Theatre. I literally mentor young kids, young emerging poets between those age brackets, and they slam at the Soweto Poetry Derby every last Thursday of the month. I love the fact that you're a filmmaker, because we've had so many challenges in documenting, right, the show, right? It's so important to document the show, because when people ask, where do we go to find your work, or does this exist, that's an archive. Oh. It's a digital footprint that lives to say we are here, right? Sometimes we're not able to get it right. So I have particularly been struggling to get that right. I do have footage of my babies who are up online, who are performing, and they're phenomenal. They're young, because what they do in the US is they start them early. They have big platforms where they nurture young emerging talent. So you'll find somebody who's 25, when I saw at 35, you sit in the room and you feel like this person is so much more achieved than you are, but they're so young, and you realize that it's because they began cultivating this culture at a very young age. So that's exactly what I'm trying to do, but I'm also trying to just archive it and put it up to also encourage young minds in the hood, you know. So I would love to be in touch with you.
So, Sia, take Mondi's contacts, and then we'll keep them in touch. We'll keep her in touch with Thabiso and Mandisa. I was actually about to ask this question when Thabiso mentioned publishers, and I was like, how difficult is it to submit your work and it's too rigid and raw, and they're like, oh, tone it down. Khotso says, hi, Clement, and your guest. I'm an accountant in the sector.
Great.
I have realized that artists are very rigid.
Yes.
They are not open to do adjustments to their scripts, for instance, so that they can be sellable, so that later when they're established and they're influential, they can afford to be purists about their art. Mm. They're not even willing to partner up to build studios and leverage their skills and secure employment for themselves. They want only to do blockbuster stuff. And I'm really saddened sometimes when I see artists like that.
I'm here. I don't think like that. Call me. I want to build studios. I,
which artists have you been talking to? Which artists? We're doing the groundwork. We're literally doing the work that nobody else has the capacity for. It's not blockbuster work. Yeah. Groundwork means I don't have a venue for poetry workshops, which means I'm gathering 20 kids at my house. Yeah. We're doing serious groundwork. Mm. So if he has a plan and he's like, guys, I think this is how you should position. Listen, we are here. We're not here for blockbuster. We're not here for fly by night. We're in it for the long haul. We've been here for over a decade.
Do you sometimes face a situation where they ask you to adjust something so that it's sellable? Because maybe it's too raw or it's too uncomfortable and the audience is not ready for it.
Again, it goes back to what is the purpose of that writing? Mm. You know, and for me, advertising taught me that very well, where you stop being precious about your writing. You know, there's work that you do for yourself. This is me, the artist. I know how I want to present the work. And I also need to consider where I stage the work. You know what I mean? When someone comes to me and says, I have a piece of communication I want to put out. I have a poem I would like commissioned about a certain topic. This is what I'm trying to communicate. You are now taking on a brief. You now have a duty, a responsibility to that client to deliver what they are asking for. Mm. You see what I mean? So you have to step outside of you as the artist, bring the magic that makes you the artist, because that's what the client is looking for, but give the client what they want. And I think that is a mindset, especially when you're young. It also bleeds, I mean, from, you know, hip hop purists, jazz purists, theater purists, you know, but it's a mindset that, as soon as you start realizing where the money is, you start getting rid of that mindset very quickly.
Hey, don't let money dilute us, please.
No, it's a necessity. It's a vehicle for all our dreams and everything we imagine for the sector to come to fruition. Yeah. But I mean, the last commissioned work I did, I believe in writing at my own pace, right? And I remember my deadline was like, it was 24 hours and I was like, we're going to have to stretch it to 48 hours because we're going to edit and go back and forth. Mm. I think in about 48 hours, the poem was out, certain lines were edited, you know, and it was engagement, it was a conversation that maybe let's try a different word because that is not within our language bracket.
But it still keeps the essence of the message.
Yeah, and they'll give you a word to say, I'm not writing the poem for you, but maybe let's try and use this word instead. Here's a synonym, you know what I mean? Mm. You have to be open to that kind of environment, you know, as a poet.
But you must also fight sometimes.
Mm. If you believe, if there is reason to, if you're not just being precious about the poem, but you, if there's reason to fight, and if you can defend the work, or if you can negotiate, because you know, Khure, I have negotiation ground, particularly because what I'm saying is valid and it makes sense, then I'm sure they'll hear you.
Yep.
But if you're just like, oh, actually that. That was a better option. I think you're making
it's
sense.
It's my work. No,
don't dilute it. How dare you?
Yeah.
Let's play the last voice note.
Clement, ha ke itse gore ke letse mogolo kwa ne khotsa kelle. These poems are powerful. Now I'm 75 this year, but I always loved poetry and reading. Yo bana ba ba bantu seletsa.
Hey.
Thank you very much for a nice program.
Something
very important, you know. She says she's 75.
Yeah.
Ishmael Mohammed said that poetry is one of the few art forms that actually keeps audiences, intergenerational audiences. So like from 18 to 50, 60, 70 plus.
Mm.
And if we captivate you at 15, we can actually captivate you up until you get to 70. That's precious.
Ah, that is really precious.
Yep.
Okay, how do people get a hold of you?
Me on social media at Afurakan, AFURAKAN, Twitter. And
you don't want us to find
Facebook,
you on social media, hey?
And Facebook.
I mean, now I must think, Afurakan, how do I spell it?
Think Afrika, Afurakan. You can also email me, tabiso.mohare@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Reach out. Otherwise, look for Word and Sound on Google to see some of the work that we've done and we're busy doing.
And you?
And how do people join your kids Mandy that you mentor?
Yes! I love my babies. They're doing so well. We had our first Soweto Poetry Derby and they were on fire. And I'm going to throw them into the industry soon. I'm just going to be like, you know
nice.
What? Go, because that's the whole point, right? Mm-hmm. If we have access, mm-hmm. then we must give them access. That's why we start this. At Mandy Vundla, MandiVundla on all social media platforms, Poetry Zone ZA. Mandisa at PoetryZoneZA.com.
Wonderful. Guys, thank you so much. You guys are brilliant. I'm thank hoping so that much. I can bring you back and you can give us more of your work.
Please, I'll please.
Yeah, sure, do the things.
Yeah. Show.
A poetry show, eh? Where we just, express. I hope you're listening. Thank you so much, guys. It's 6 minutes before 12.